From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the 2019 Coachella lineup is out, but can it ever live up to last year's epic Beyoncé show? Then Kit Steinkellner, the creator of the Facebook Watch series Sorry for Your Loss, explains what it was like to pitch TV executives on her show about grief.
Buyers were afraid people would not want to live with this pain, and I think actually I'm seeing the reverse is true, that people are so grateful that their pain is being acknowledged and it feels cathartic.
And Janelle Monáe deconstructs a song from her Grammy-nominated album, Dirty Computer. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Coachella has released its 2019 lineup, and despite the rumors, Kanye West will not be headlining. Instead, Childish Gambino, Tame Impala, and Ariana Grande will top the bill this year, followed by a diverse array of pop musicians. Although few expect it to surpass Beychella, Beyoncé's headlining performance from last year, reactions to this April's roster have been optimistic. In his analysis for the LA Times, pop music writer August Brown noted an increased female presence, a wide range of genres, and a strong showing of international acts. When we spoke this morning, he started with his reaction to seeing the lineup.
I think this year was the year that Coachella finally realized it's a pop festival, but they did it in a really interesting, diverse, and tasteful way that culls from a lot of different trends happening in music right now that, you know, people that are used to going to see Roger Waters and the classic rock reunions of yore probably won't recognize a lot of the things on this bill. But I think anybody in the younger generation is going to have a real solid representation of what musical life is like right now.
And how would you say they've done in terms of the balance between male and female? Like a lot of festivals, Coachella has not done great historically. The trend has been in a more positive direction. Do you feel like they're making some progress?
Yeah, I think this year is really representative. I think, you know, Ariana Grande is one of, I think, only maybe four or five female headliners at the festival. But there's a lot of really interesting stuff within the top two or three lines of every night. And you can tell that was a priority. I mean, you have Janelle Monáe and the K-pop band Blackpink and Solange, and then obviously Ariana. And yeah, I think, you know, it's not just good morally. I think it's good music and that people want to hear and are demanding right now.
A lot of people might not have heard of Childish Gambino, which is Donald Glover's nom de music before his huge hit with This Is America.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping, no. Don't catch you slipping, no.
How did that one song transform his career from somebody who a lot of people knew and liked, but is now a Coachella headliner?
Yeah, that song is one of the few singles that he's had recently that have really vaulted his profile. Obviously, Redbone was a huge international hit. But This Is America, I think, was one of the most striking kind of pop culture artifacts of last year, because the video was so trenchant and interesting and had so much to say about contemporary American political life, while the song, which was absolutely just pure smoke, too. And I think that really vaulted him from, you know, a generally liked pop culture figure into one of the more important artists going today.
If you look at the three headliners, Childish Gambino, Ariana Grande, and Tame Impala, other than the fact that they're the three headliners, do you think they have anything in common?
There's no real trend for the three headliners other than that the definition of pop is really expanded this year to include a lot of different kinds of things. And I think the Latin trap kind of movement happening this year is especially interesting, with the likes of Bad Bunny and then J Balvin's kind of reggaeton crossovers. Yeah, having a K-pop act on the bill, I think, is really high, is really important. And yeah, I think Coachella has taken a very, not looking for a trend per se, but just taking a really expansive look at what people are actually listening to right now. And I think they found it.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the international acts, and specifically about K-pop. There's a girl group called Blackpink, and this song is called As If It's Your Last. There is a blend of styles. There's English, there's Korean. What's going on with this band and K-pop more broadly?
Yeah, K-pop had a really big year last year. The group BTS had a Billboard number one album, the first for the genre. And I think the placement on the poster is really interesting, because They're not treating this as some kind of novelty that, you know, fans might look at curiosity. They're on the second line of the bill because they're one of the biggest acts on one of the globe's most influential genres.
Compared to past years, there are not a lot of veteran acts. I would say maybe Weezer is probably the most prominent of the older acts. There's a lot of emphasis on younger musicians, including Pasadena's own Billie Eilish. Let's hear a little bit of Eilish's song, When the Party's Over.
Call me friend, but keep me closer.
Call me back.
And I'll call you.
So I think it's hard for any festival to be current and young and not be craven. How did the festival walk the line in terms of blending talent with record sales?
Well, I think in terms of what you just played with Billie Eilish, they have a few artists from, I guess, the genre. It's been kind of maybe tongue-in-cheek described as Spotify core, but I think it's more interesting than that. It's some very young female producers and singer-songwriters. It's like her and Claro and King Princess, who are really kind of defining pop as a thing meant for close listening in terms of like having very down-tempo, intimate sonics and really confessional lyrics, while also having a real kind of strong contemporary feminism to it. It racks up huge numbers on streaming, and people really are paying attention to it. And I think, Coachella just saw a real undercurrent happening from this world, and they did the right thing by putting so many of these young women so high on the bill.
Now, you know these lists better than anybody, so who would be a couple of artists that maybe are not on everybody's radar who are definitely worth checking out if they attend this year?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I'm going to shout out an L.A. rapper. His name is JPEG Mafia. He puts on probably the most incendiary live show I saw all of last year, and he is very much on the ascent. It's not easy listening, that's for sure. It's pretty punk-inspired noise rap, but he's just one of the most charismatic artists in L.A. right now, and I recommend him ultra highly. And then there's an artist named Rosalia who had a pretty incredible last year. She's a, I guess, experimental flamenco. She's from Spain and kind of draws on a lot of those traditions, but you don't often hear something that sounds brand new today, but she's got a sound that you can pretty safely say hasn't been done before.
August Brown is a pop music writer at the LA Times. August, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Facebook Watch has a hit on its hands with a series about grief.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite. Nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards for Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Screenplay, and Best Picture of the Year. Also nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Best Picture, and one of AFI's 10 Best Pictures of the Year, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Grief and loss are things that we all experience at some point. Whether or not we want to be reminded of those feelings while watching a movie or a TV show is another question. So it's understandable that when Kit Steinkellner was trying to pitch TV executives with her idea for a series about a grieving widow, it was a tough sell. She shopped the series called Sorry for Your Loss for 5 years before it found a home on Facebook Watch. That's the social network's relatively new platform for original content. And now Sorry for Your Loss has been renewed for a second season. Elizabeth Olsen plays Lee Shaw, a young widow grappling with the death of her husband, Matt. We meet her 3 months after he died. She's starting to realize that she might not have known Matt as well as she thought she did, even as she's trying to figure out how to move on. In this scene, she tells a fellow widow, who she's met in a group counseling session, that she doesn't want to be friends.
I don't want to feel pressured to respond to messages and say yes to plans and hear your stories that frankly make me feel terrible about my life. And I would rather be angry and mean when I feel like it, because that's what I need right now.
Kit Steinkellner was a playwright before she began writing for television. Her parents are writers and producers, probably best known for their work on Cheers. So I asked her if working in television was something that she always saw herself doing.
No, I feel like I was one of those kids that wasn't good at anything. I feel like I was good at reading books and watching movies. I was incredibly passive. I got really lucky. My sophomore year of high school, I grew up in Santa Barbara. My theater teacher offered a playwriting class. It was essentially like a glorified independent study. You just sat in the library like during fifth period for a year, and by the end you were supposed to write a play, and I fell in love. It was like the two times I've fallen in love were like with my husband and with playwriting. So kind of the rest from there on out, I just kept writing and writing and writing.
When you were thinking about this story, did you always imagine it as this kind of format? Do you think about it as a play, a novel? How do you know what the shape of the story is going to be once you come up with the idea?
Yeah, for Sorry for Your Loss, it was interesting. I always knew it was a TV show. I heard, I forget which AMC executive said this, but the quote is, a movie is about a solvable problem and a TV show is about an unsolvable problem. And that is the engine of the show, is you just cannot solve the problem. That's why you have multiple episodes and multiple seasons. And of course, death is the great unsolvable problem, so that it really made sense for so many reasons for this to be a TV show.
I want to ask you about a very difficult night in your own personal life.
Yeah.
Where your husband went missing. He's fine. He came home. But for a while, you were out of contact with him. How did that experience start to shape the idea for this series?
Yeah, I just remember all night long, I was up till 6 in the morning thinking, if my husband is dead, my life is over, but my life can't be over because I'm still going to be alive. So what am I going to do? And even when I found out he was okay, I don't know. It just, that night hung over me like a dark cloud. I couldn't shake it. And it had been a year where a couple people in my life had died. So it really, you just have those bad years where you feel like the vultures are circling. And I just felt intensely vulnerable and unsafe. And the more I started, I was wrestling with this. I really couldn't shake it. And I just started thinking about who that person was that could survive this impossible thing. And this character, played by Lizzie Olson, came into focus. And the more I thought about her, the more the people in her life came into focus, and the more that pilot story came into focus.
Typically, when showrunners put together a writing room, they not only see people with different experiences and backgrounds, but also people who have some knowledge about the subject at hand. Was it important to you that you at least had writers who had either suffered a personal loss? How did you go about casting that room so that you avoided the cliches that the series itself is trying to examine?
It just sort of ended up that a lot of people in our room had suffered loss, because that just is, you get to a certain age, it's just part of the human experience. And it was something that I looked for, but it definitely wasn't a deciding factor. I knew the type of person I wanted in the room. I knew I needed them to be incredibly emotionally intelligent and deeply curious. So when I was reading scripts, I was looking for people who I thought could write the show. And then when I interviewed maybe like a dozen people out of the like 200-300 scripts I read, it came down to, did I think this person could bring something to the show that I couldn't bring? And it is experience, but it's also sensibility, voice, POV. For example, we have a writer who's dealt with some serious health issues. And so this person isn't a widow or a widower, but they've looked death straight on, and they brought a lot of experience and heart to the show, I think largely as a result of those experiences.
There is a different level of collaboration on this series, though, and that is the collaboration with the audience. Because
yeah.
You're on a social media platform, people are reacting almost in real time to what they're seeing and sharing their feelings in the comments. Do you look? Do you care? Do you insulate yourself from it? What's your take on it?
I wasn't going to. Having been a playwright, if you're emotionally intelligent, you don't read the reviews. So I was not going to read feedback. But then ultimately I had to, because people were being so open-hearted and vulnerable. And it is, it's one of the reasons we chose Facebook as our home, is this is the place where you find out people have been born, that people have died. It's the largest public square in human history. And so it made sense
to tell a story about this on the platform where so much of this information is being shared. I had to look, and I'm constantly gratified and overwhelmed by how much the show has meant to people to feel seen and heard in this way. I think there are people who feel, weirdly, again, I think one of the tricky things about selling the show is I think people, buyers, were afraid people would not want to live with this pain. And I think actually I'm seeing the reverse is true, that people are so grateful that their pain is being acknowledged and it feels cathartic rather than depressing or grim.
Well, I would say a lot of the comments that I've seen have been from people in Lee's position who have suddenly lost someone who's very close to them. And one woman who lost her mother last year singled out this scene. It's from the first episode between Lee and Danny, who is Matt's brother. And Matt is Lee's late husband.
I hate how in the beginning everyone wants to send you flowers and donate to like a foundation for your dead person. And they stop calling and writing and doing nice things for you because they're over it and they expect you to be over it.
I hate it when people ask me if I was close to my brother. Like they're trying to decide how sorry they have to feel for me. And they want me to say not close, as if that would make it better, whatever.
Could you tell me about that scene, about its origins?
Yeah, I mean, that scene was in the first draft. That was always so important to me because for me, your pilot contains the DNA of your series. And I think that in particular is the DNA. That scene contains the DNA of our series, that we're tackling cliches and stereotypes. We're taking on the things that have been portrayed in film and television that have made people feel so isolated, alone, and alone because it feels so radically removed from their own personal experience.
The other thing that's happening is people aren't just kind of reacting to the story. There are things like polls where people are like saying there's a scene where Lee goes to Palm Springs using an anniversary gift that was intended for her and her husband. Yeah. He's no longer alive, so they can't go together. And she goes, and people are like, would you have taken the trip? Would you not have taken the trip? And it feels like it's almost started a kind of conversation running parallel to the show about how people would see themselves in similar situations.
Yeah, no, and the good news is, as a creator and a writer, I pretty much agree with the results of the polls. Like, usually it's like 70% say yes or no, and I'm like, yeah, that's what we intended. Good. I think we are on the same page as the audience in these respects. No spoilers, but I think that episode ended up being weirdly, I think, one of the more controversial episodes or stories for people, I think, because she takes a step that I think some people weren't sure whether she could or should take. And it's always interesting to, I think you have this think tank of writers, you have your producers, you have your actors, and you all wrestle with ideas and stories. And then sometimes someone says something online, you're like, that never came up. Usually the points of view come up, but sometimes you learn something new.
So I know Facebook is your home. It's fair to say Facebook has not had a good year, especially in terms of what it's done to some of its critics, like George Soros. How do you feel about this whole conversation that is happening around Facebook right now about people saying, I don't want to be a part of it. I don't think what they're doing is good, even though that's the home for your show?
Yeah, no, it's obviously, it's very tricky. What I will say is, the amount of good I've seen our show do, I don't think we could facilitate this conversation and do this kind of good on a different platform in the same way to foster that kind of community. So, I hear you, I understand. And at the same time, again, it's cheesy and corny, but I see the lives we've changed and I see the difference that we make every single day. And I'm proud of it. So, again, we live in a very binary culture where things are, good and evil, right and wrong. But I think we have to kind of live in the gray on this one because we've done a lot of good on this platform.
Maybe the solution is, if you must use Facebook, just go to Facebook Watch and watch Sorry for Your Loss.
I'm not going to argue with that.
Kit Stein-Kellner is the creator and executive producer and writer on the Facebook Watch series, Sorry for Your Loss. Kit, great to see you. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thanks.
All 10 episodes of Sorry for Your Loss are available now on Facebook Watch. Coming up, Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer has a Grammy nomination for Album of the Year, and we hear her deconstruct a song from that album.
About being someplace at some time. Whoa, but I don't really mind. 'Cause I could
could be on easy. Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today is Thursday, and that's the day when The Frame's weekly newsletter goes out. It's a great way to keep up with our show and get headlines from the world of culture, and it always includes tips for how to spend the coming weekend in Southern California. You could sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. And now an episode from Song Exploder. That's the podcast by our friend Rishi Kesh Hirway, in which he sits down with musicians and has them deconstruct one of their songs. Today, it's Janelle Monáe. Last year, she released her third album titled Dirty Computer, and it has a Grammy nomination for Album of the Year. The album includes a song called So Afraid, and in this episode of the Song Exploder podcast, Monáe breaks apart So Afraid to explain how she built it, and it all began with a trip to the dentist.
This is Janelle Monáe. It was October 13th, 2015. I had a toothache, and I was on the way to the dentist. And I was in a very introspective mood at the time, asking myself questions around my fears, around my anxieties, but I was dealing with a toothache. And so I took Advil, got in my car, and I'm riding on the highway. And that is when I had the idea for So Afraid. Okay, talk about all the things that you're afraid of in this very moment. And whenever I have an idea, I'll pull out my phone and I'll press the voice memo.
I'm afraid that you won't love me. I'm afraid you judge me so. I'm afraid that you look at me not like the hero. I'm afraid that you tell my family that I'm not who I am. I'm afraid that I can never ever be on Instagram.
I was like, okay, let's get it out. Let's get it out. Let's get it out. What are you afraid of? What are these things that have been holding you back, giving you anxiety? Let's just talk about that.
I'm so afraid. I'm so afraid. Oh.
What I ended up doing was getting back to the studio and playing it for Nate Wonder, who is my music collaborator, and telling him exactly how I wanted the song to go. So right now you hear Nate Wonder playing the guitar. Whenever I'm building a song, I like to start with guitar or piano because I think that great songs are able to be played with just the minimal instrumentation and it still resonate with you. And I wanted it to really be about my voice.
All the kids run around playing free and fun while the dogs lap around the camp.
I wanted to just highlight kids in my neighborhood back in Kansas City, Kansas, running through the ghetto with not a care in the world. I envy kids sometimes because they don't know about the world. You know, they haven't dealt with police brutality. They haven't dealt with gun violence. They're just so pure. And it's just like this moment where you wish, like, man, if I would have known what I knew when I was 7 years old, I would have been saying thank you every single day for those days. But then
daughters sharpen the knives and they hunt for food while they watch their children grow.
Daughters sharpen the knives and they hunt for food. It's a metaphor for girls and women and how tough we have to be. You know, I am this queer Black woman who grew up to working class parents who every single day is reminded by those in the position of power that we don't care about women. I had to have more armor because in this world that I'm growing up in, it's not always going to be safe for me. As I kept recording the song, I started to realize that there was power in vulnerability. And I realized that the times that I connected most and that I was encouraged and inspired most was by the vulnerabilities of others. The way that they were able to talk about their insecurities did something remarkable.
And I'm afraid. I'm so afraid.
There's so much power in admitting that we are afraid, afraid of loving the person that folks say you shouldn't love, afraid of forgiving America for the things that they've done to the Black and brown folks or to the LGBTQIA community. You're just afraid to trust your country, and you're just afraid to love yourself. And so I think that this song represents that, what it means to live in such a fearful state.
What if I lose? Is what I think to myself. I'm fine in my shell. I'm afraid of it all, afraid of loving you.
One of the things that I've always wanted to do was to make timeless, futuristic music that you can play it in the future. You can play it if you travel back. And so the thing that I love most about the song is the synths. They bring this sense of like eeriness to the song, the sense of futurism. I felt lighter after I recorded So Afraid. I felt like I unpacked some things, like what it really means to love myself and what it means to allow myself to be loved and to fall deeply in love with another person. I think that openly talking about fears keeps us connected. I feel so much more inspired and encouraged to move forward when somebody is telling me about their imperfections and then they come out of them. It's just like, how is a leader made? How is a broken person able to become a brave person? Vulnerability, there's so much power in it.
All the kids run around playing free and fun while the dogs lap around the camp. Falling down, climbing trees, swimming in the river, no life jacket on their backs.
Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer has a Grammy nomination for Album of the Year. You can hear a longer version of that session with her at songexploder.net. And that's all we have for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.
I'm so afraid.